So here we are at part three of Kabbalah, You and the Cosmic Christ. So at the end of this, we'll be halfway through. And trust me, I don't have any possibility of shoehorning in everything I would like to teach you on this course. Because for a start, I don't know everything. I don't actually know anybody else who's investigating the Gospels the way I am. But it's so full of stuff that's incredible that I'll probably be teaching this workshop every year from now on. It'll be different every year. But tonight we're looking at atonement, crucifixion, death and resurrection. So nothing particularly important then. Look at slide number two, which is where we're going to start. And we're returning to this idea of four worlds, four levels of interpretation. On the Tree of Life, there are all sorts of numbers that we work with. 10 is the primary one for the 10 Sephirot, 12 because of the 11th Sephirot, and the one called Da'at, and also the fact that you're observing it, which makes the sacred number of 12. There's also 3 for the Trinity, and 7 for the lower areas of the world and the chakras, and 22 paths. I could go on. But we're focusing still on just four levels. And as there are four Gospels, that's entirely appropriate if we're discussing Jesus and Christ. So we've got four levels, and Kabbalah teaches that the Bible has to be interpreted on these four levels because it won't make any sense whatsoever if you don't. 99% of folk will just interpret it on the literal level. And the literal level is the physical world of a seer, and it's basically, did this happen, did it not happen? Is this historical? Is it real? And it's quite obvious that some of the Bible isn't historical and isn't real. For example, there's no evidence whatsoever, mind you, I mean, we haven't got much evidence full stop, but there's no evidence whatsoever that the exodus from Egypt actually did happen during the time of Ramses or any other time. There's no documentation about it. Of course, it could be a cover-up, could be a conspiracy theory, who knows? But there's an awful lot in the Bible that cannot be proven. And that's fair enough, because in a way, that's intended to make us look deeper. We live in such an information-strewn time now that we tend to go on the is it true, isn't it true, if it isn't true, we throw it out mode. But the point of being a mystic, the point of studying our souls and our spiritual development is to know that always there are different levels that we have to look at things on. So the second level, which is the world of Yetzirah, the psychological world, is the allegory. The third level, which is Berea, the spiritual world, is the mystical level. And the fourth level, which is the world of Atzilut, the divine one, is metaphysical. We'll come back to those in a minute, but slide number three just reminds us that there are two halves of life. This is what the great Christian mystics, people like Thomas Keating and Richard Rohr teach, and Thomas Merton did too, that we build a container, a vessel, which forms our ego in the first half of life, and then we use that as the launching point to develop the second half of life. So the Hebrew Testament, the Old Testament, is laying down the law. It has an awful lot of Yahweh in it and God laying down the law right, left and centre. But the New Testament, the New Covenant, is where, when and how to break the law. How does love trump law? Those are the teachings of Jesus all the time. Where does love break the law? And primary in that is, let he that is without sin cast the first stone. If we just lived by that, well, Facebook and Twitter would be shut within about 24 hours, I should imagine, for a start. Slide number four now. Let's have a look at this four levels of the Bible with one particular story from the Old Testament, which is David smiting the enemy. And you'll see this a lot in the Old Testament, in that he left neither man nor woman alive. He took the sheep, the oxen, the asses, the camels, and the clothing. He took everything. It was a complete wipeout. And of course, in the literal world nowadays, where we have war crimes, that would be seen as a war crime to take out the women and the children and to take away all the way means that they had, of if anybody was still there, to rebuild. So let's look at this on the four levels. Number one, did it actually happen? Well, Maybe it did. We can take from history that humanity is constantly doing this kind of thing, constantly laying waste to countryside and to human beings and animal life. So it's entirely possible that it may have happened. And if it did happen, have we learnt anything from it? Maybe not. And the second one, the allegory, what's this story actually about? Where is the story? Where is the message in the story? Where is the psychological allegory? I mean, this one, there's karma. What is going on here karmically? You have to read the whole of the Book of Samuel to look at that one. But you've got all sorts of stories of Saul and Jonathan and David and the play between humanity. And you actually have to read it on that level. But also, in the allegory, this is, are we actually talking about a physical story or are we talking about David's psychological journey? And one of the things that is taught in our tradition, in the Toledano tradition, is that if you actually want to become Christed, which none of us are, this generation, I can pretty much put my hand on heart and say, I don't know anybody in this tradition who's Christed. But the point is, if you're going to get to that level, and that's our goal over many, many lifetimes, we have to destroy the enemy. And the enemy is the demons within. The enemy is our unconscious of subconscious demons. It's got nothing to do with the external world. But if we don't destroy the demons, every one of them, they will come back. Jesus tells a parable about this, and I'm just doing this off the top of my head now, so I haven't got the biblical reference, but you can find it. He tells a parable of a man who has a demon in his body and his psyche, and the demon is thrown out, and the man cleans up his psyche so that it looks really nice and it's really pretty, but the demon has nowhere to go, so he looks at the man and sees how wonderful and clean his psyche is, and thinks, oh, that's a nice place to go. So he rounds up a load of other demons and they all move in together. Now, what that really means is that the man had not totally cleaned up his psyche. Demons are negative thoughts, negative feelings, negative habits, negative practices. If we don't destroy the root of them, like a weed, they will grow again and they will even get stronger. If you cut back a buddleia bush, it's twice the size next year. So the allegory for the Hebrew Testament, and indeed some of the stories in the New Testament, is how willing are you to do the work required to destroy all your inner troubles? And the answer for most of us is, I'm not. And that's why the Bible stories in the Hebrew Testament repeat and repeat and repeat, because the Israelites do not destroy all their own inner demons. The third level, the spiritual level, is quite personal to us, which is, what does this story say to me about my ego, myself, my soul, my spiritual journey? And of course, the first more egoic version would be how cruel, how mean, all war is wrong. And you have to just start looking at your own prejudices and realizing that those prejudices are part of the demonic aspect of ourselves, the negative aspect, which we are projecting onto the world. So each one of these will link in with each other, but we have to look at where does the Bible really piss us off? Because the bits where it makes us angry or upset are the bits which are part of our own projection, of our own darkness, of our own anger, of our own grief, and our own unwillingness to destroy the negativity within us. And again, don't feel too bad about this. None of us are getting out here alive. None of us are going to do it in one lifetime. It's a very big book, and it's got a huge amount of work in it if we know how to work with it. The fourth level, absolute, the divine level, is how does this story demonstrate humanity's evolution? Does it have a lesson for humanity? Is it demonstrating which direction we're going in? And certainly in all the prophets are telling us all the time we're going down the wrong path. The prophets are highlighting again and again that the world is the first level of evil. The way things are, the system. And once the system gets in place and we're inside it, it's really hard to see where the damages and the wrong things are in the system. people in spirituality, New Age, conspiracy theories, all that kind of thing, are sitting a little bit outside the system, and they can see what's wrong in the system, and they'll start shouting. But it's like shouting about the emperor's new clothes, because people in the system really cannot see it, because the system benefits us. And also those who are shouting outside it are usually using anger, which is going to make the problem bigger. As soon as you put a lot of emotion into something, you make it bigger. And anger strengthens the thing you're opposing. Only love heals. It's slow, but love is the healer. Anger can sort of get you risen up into doing something, but if you do stuff against, you make things stronger. Mother Teresa was very firm about this. She always said, "I will never march against war. I will march for peace." So slide number 4, and this is where everything starts off, with the book of Genesis and the story of what's known as the fall from the Garden of Eden. Christianity is taught that Jesus came to atone for our original sin. Odd that, because the Jewish nation has no concept of original sin. They know about the fall in the Garden of Eden, but they don't project it onto the rest of humanity. In the Jewish tradition, we are not born sinful, we're born perfect. We take on sin and we behave badly, but there's no sin that comes down to us karmically from Adam. And frankly, if Jesus had done the atonement, there still shouldn't be any sin coming down to us karmically from Adam, because he should have sorted it. But original Christianity had no concept of that. It was not about Jesus coming to save us in that respect. So we need to look at what it was about. The doctrine itself of atonement, there are all sorts of theories of atonement. There's redemptive, there's surrender, there's... Well, you have to look on Wikipedia to find out all the theories of atonement, but it's basically always, we went wrong from the very, very beginning, we're still being blamed for it, and if it weren't for Jesus, God would still hate us. It's basically the lesson we get taught again and again. And this idea of sin, human sin, comes straight from the first level of evil, as highlighted in the prophets, because the second level of evil is the flesh. And the flesh is the individual sin, where we steal something, we tell fibs, or sexual sin, like adultery or bestiality or paedophilia, that kind of thing. But the prophets teach that when the system is in place, that second level of sin becomes almost automatic, because when we're in the system, we become immune to what's right and wrong at that level, and we will behave for our own gratification more than we will behave for the good of the universe. And the third level of sin, the devil, is when we present these two evils as good. It's, for example, the Jimmy Savile story in the United Kingdom, who was a man who presented himself as a great philanthropist, raising vast amounts of money for children at Stoke Mandeville Hospital, but who was actually a serial paedophile, abusing and raping children. But he went around telling people how good he was and what wonderful work he did. And even those who suspected didn't dare knock him down because of the money he was raising for hospitals. And every now and then when somebody got close to him and threatened to pull him out, he said, "If you do that, all the money raising stops." And that is the devil in evil. Because that's actually saying, "I am doing good here. You do not point out my failings." And that's a tricky one. That is a big, big one. Anyway, let's go back to the Garden of Eden and the whole Adam and Eve story. For the Kabbalist, again, you're going to read it on four levels. And for the Kabbalist, this is a huge allegory. Literally, it's humanity disobeying God. Well, we do that every day if we believe in all the commandments. In the story of Genesis, God does say directly, "Do not eat from that tree." So it was a disobedience. If you take it purely at the literal level, and if you're working at that level, it's going to be perfectly easy to come along to the idea of atonement being needed and Jesus needing to sacrifice himself for our sins. Because if we are going to disobey commands of God, we're going to fall into the sins of the flesh. and we're also going to go for the sins of the devil, and we're going to make the sins of the world worse because we're not obeying good. In the Hebrew Testament, it always also says, fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, but it's always fear of Yahweh, who's the God who lays down the law. And a better translation of it is actually respect for the law is the beginning of wisdom. But again, that's looking at that from further up the level rather than literally at the literal level. The allegory in the Garden of Eden story of the disobedience is it's very simply the first lesson in choice and consequence. And you cannot incarnate on a planet without understanding and applying choice and consequence. We're trying to do it pretty well at the moment, but whenever we choose something, whenever we do that, there is a kickback, a good one or a bad one. Every action creates an equal and opposite reaction. Everything we do brings back a choice. So the allegory there is to say, if you eat something you're not supposed to eat, you're going to suffer. And also, if you eat from the tree of good knowledge and become like gods, knowing what is good and knowing what is evil, given the system and given the sins of the flesh and given the devil, are you actually mature enough and capable enough to handle that knowledge? And the answer at the psychological level is 9 times out of 10, absolutely not. So the allegory is that we have got the ability to judge good and evil, and we're not ready for it. We got it by default, and we're not ready for it. The third level, the mystical, is the story of the quickening of the divine child. And I'm going to tell you the story that's come down the feminine oral tradition about the book of Genesis. And it's Eve's story rather than Adam's story. But the story is this. In the beginning, the Elohim, the goddess, created the heaven and the earth to make a womb for the divine baby, for the Christ to which she was giving birth. And the Christ would be born through a myriad of human beings, each one cell in the soul of the divine baby. So the Elohim created this beautiful universe in the worlds of Berea and Yetzirah. The story of Eden takes place in the physical world. It's before incarnation. So when the Elohim created this paradise with all the creatures in it, and Adam and Eve, the first man and the first woman, the Elohim was expecting this to be the first forming of the baby, so the baby would quicken and grow. But in Eden, nothing changed and nothing happened. So the baby was looking as though it was going to be stillborn. Nothing was growing. Nothing was changing. And the Elohim moved over the waters of the earth and across the beauty of the earth, which was the place that Adam and Eve would be ready to come to when they had quickened, when they had come to life, when they were real, rather than just images. And as the Elohim passed over the waters, she saw an oyster with a pearl in its shell. And she went down to the oyster and said, "Oh, oyster, what is this beautiful thing that you've created? What is this? Because I did not make that. I, the creator of this universe, did not make that. How did it get there?" And the oyster said, "Well, my lady, I hope you don't mind. I did create it myself. I created it because some grit got into my shell. And because the grit got into my shell, it hurt. And I was uncomfortable, so I created this to surround the grit because I couldn't expel it, and now I'm not in any pain anymore, and I hope you don't object." And the Elohim said, "Object? Why would I object? It's the most beautiful thing I've ever seen in my life, and I didn't make it." This is the answer. This is it. So the Elohim went back to Eden and called Adam and said, "Do you see that tree over there? With beautiful fruit on it, don't touch it. You may not touch the tree. You may not eat from the tree." So Adam told Eve, and God went away. And the moment that Eve made the choice, and Eve did make the choice, to eat from the tree. The first disobedience was the first decision that humanity made on its own. And the second that decision was made, the baby quickened with life. And God knew that humanity understood choice. Therefore, it was a setup. Because let's face it, any of you who've got children know perfectly well that if you've got a couple of young children in a room and you have to leave the room for a while, and there's a box on the table in the room, if you say to that child, you can do anything you like, eat all the candy, look at all the books, but don't touch the box. Don't open the box. Do not open the box. There's something in the box you're not allowed to look at. Don't open the box. Do anything you like. Don't open the box. And then the parent leaves the room. You know what would happen next. Children are going to go straight to the box. Terry Pratchett summed it up beautifully by saying, if there was an end of the world button on a wall somewhere, the paint would not have time to dry. So for the mystic, it isn't a fall in the first place. It's certainly the descent from Eden. And God does say to Adam and Eve, because of the choice you've made, you're going to suffer. Because once you are in the physical world has physical pain and physical suffering, and childbirth is painful. Even my friend Alex, who managed to give birth for the first time and the second time in less than 3 hours, because she'd done yoga and hypnotherapy and things like that. And as she's a Leo, now goes around being most annoyingly superior to all the other mothers she knows who are in labour for 24 hours or more. But labour hurts. So God is just stating the facts. Life on the planet is going to hurt. In many places, it's going to hurt. And the sooner we know that, the better. Richard Rohr teaches the concept of necessary suffering, which we may have time to look at in a different webinar, but not tonight. And the final level, the fourth level, is the metaphysical one, which brings us, all these levels will intertwine with each other, to the concept of judging good and evil. And the reason we're told not to eat from the tree of knowledge is because we become like gods. We will judge good and evil. And we're taught that only God is the one who knows everything. God's the only one with the overarching picture. Yes, it's easy enough for us to say that Hitler was evil, but many things that we judge as evil may not be, and many things that we judge as good may not be, because we simply do not know. So for the metaphysical, it's how has humanity progressed and how is humanity progressing with this gift that we took from Eden on the judging of good and evil? And the answer is we're not doing terribly well right now. So moving on from there to slide 7, we're looking at the idea of plan A and plan B. Because Christianity, with the atonement theory and this concept of original sin, which some of it takes from the scapegoat, by the way. The story of the scapegoat in the Hebrew Testament is of a goat which is taken to the temple once a year, and the high priest puts on it the sins of the humans, lays all the sins of the humans onto the goat, and then it's chased out into the desert, where it will probably die to atone for our sins. So there always has been a scapegoat, which is what it was called, the goat that takes away our sins once a year. So this is a kind of plan B, that humanity is rotten and mean and dreadful, so there has to be a plan B to save us. And this is the Dominican theory. The Dominicans and the Franciscans argued about this for centuries during the Middle Ages and afterwards, and the Dominicans basically won. They liked the atonement theory. They liked the idea that we were wrong and evil and we had to be grateful to Christ for saving us, and we had to worship Christ and to accept Christ for that Saviour to be effective in us. If we turned our backs on Christ, then the piece of toffee was taken away from us. We couldn't have it. We could only be saved as long as we worshipped Christ. Franciscan theory is entirely different. St. Francis did not hold to that at all. He said, it's all plan A. It's all plan A. There is no blood atonement. We do not need to do anything for God to love us. We are God's children. We are loved. Full stop. And the great Franciscan teacher John Duns Scotus, who lived in the 13th century, made it very clear that Christ was plan A from the very beginning. It's not a mopping up exercise. It's not dependent on us messing up. Jesus did not come for for those reasons. And Father Richard Rohr on slide 8, I'm just going to read it out because I can't put it any better. And he says, did God intend no meaning or purpose for creation during the first 14.8 billion years? Was it all just empty, waiting for sinful humans to set the only real drama into motion? This is Richard talking about the fact that the cosmic Christ has been present from the first dawning of creation. Did the sun, moon and galaxies have no divine significance? The fish, the birds, the animals were just waiting for humans to appear. Was there no divine blueprint, the Logos, from the beginning? Surely this is extreme hubris and anthropomorphism of the human species. And it's true, if you think about the idea that there may be living beings on other planets, the whole of creation waiting for Jesus to come and save us on one planet, I mean, that wastes a lot of time. And Richard writes, the substitutionary atonement theory, and that's all it is, a theory, seems to imply that the eternal Christ's epiphany in Jesus is a mere afterthought when the first plan didn't work out. I know there are many temple metaphors of atonement, the scapegoat, for example, satisfaction atonement, ransom atonement, paying the price and opening the gates, but please know they're just that. They're metaphors of transformation and transitioning. Too many Christians understand these in a transactional way instead of a transformative way. That's the key to the mystical understanding of the Gospels and the whole of religious teaching. If it's transactional, which means I need you to do or be that for me to love you, it's not the teachings of Christ. If it's transformative, which is I will love you through this and through everything, I cannot stop it necessarily, but I will be there. I will be your mother and father, and I will hold you through all of this, and I will watch you transform, and I will be with you in that transformational. That is the mystical teaching of Christ. And Richard writes, how and why would God need a blood sacrifice before God could love what God has created? Is God that needy, that unfree, unloving, rule-bound, and unable to forgive? Once you say that, you see it creates a nonsensical theological notion that's very hard to defend. And also it leads us to that terrible fear of what will God ask of me if God demands violent blood sacrifice from Jesus? How can God love me if God could do that to his first begotten son? So, what is this Eden story all about, and is there a parallel in the crucifixion? Well, yes, there is. Slide number 9. The Eden story is the perennial story of humanity, because we need to look at the whole story. The serpent deceives and betrays Eve. Adam then betrays Eve again. So the lesson for all humanity from the very beginning comes down the feminine, which is, you will be betrayed. That is your necessary suffering. If you wish to grow in life, you will be betrayed. Because without that betrayal, you can't grow. You can't start the examination of good and evil, and you cannot learn forgiveness. So at the deepest aspect of these four levels, you're going to be betrayed by your body, you're going to be betrayed by yourself, your soul, and you're going to be betrayed by others. You will suffer in body and mind by being incarnate on this planet, and you will heal through dying. That doesn't mean the actual physical death, it means letting go. Death is letting go. We'll look at the crucifixion story in a little more detail in a moment. But the fact of the suffering and dying are not the message of the crucifixion. We got very tied up in the Middle Ages when life was nasty, bruised and short by people focusing on the suffering of Christ and the wounds and the pain and the tears and the blood. But that's not the biblical message. You heal through letting go of the pain and being willing to die to the problem. As soon as you're willing to die to the problem, to let it go, you resurrect. As soon as you die to the problem, resurrection is a done deal. Now, Jesus was on the cross for 6 hours. He went on the cross on the third hour and he came off the cross dead on the ninth hour. So he was there for 6 hours. Christianity keeps him on the cross now. So basically he's been on the cross for, at this point, approximately 2,000 years, give or take a while. Well, minus 30 or something like that. But we keep him on the cross all the time. And that disempowers the Christ story immediately. Now, this aspect of Christianity is in Mark specifically, and it's the suffering servant, the suffering servant aspect of Christ. It focuses on the wounds. And now Mark does have healing, but in Mark, the ending of Mark was much shorter. They didn't have aspects of the resurrection to start with. The first editing of Mark added in a little bit more hope because it ended with a real downer when Mark was first written, because the emphasis was supposed to be that if you don't actually go further than this, Mark is the psychological gospel, you're going to get stuck. But of course, people came along and went, oh no, we need the happy ending. Well, we do want a happy ending, but we need to understand the process of it. And the aspect of the suffering servant is very important to us because a lot of us have understood that Jesus, as representing the Christ, does understand our suffering. That the divine has been incarnate. It has been in pain. It does understand what physical, psychological pain is about. It does understand betrayal. And the idea of Jesus being on the cross and the fact that we are keeping him on the cross by our wicked and evil tendencies is simply vicious. Because it's telling us that we are making this innocent being suffer because we're bad. And that's where we get children being told they're bad rather than their behaviour is bad. And it takes the whole system into the demonic, because the system of Christianity is Christ died to alleviate your sins. Look at you, you're wanking under the bedclothes, pardon my language. Therefore you're evil and you're not worshipping Christ, and therefore he was on the cross for nothing, because look at the bad behaviour you're doing. And then the third level is the ones who say, I am born again, I worship Jesus, therefore I am saved. I am the good one. And Christianity is the world, the flesh and the devil personified when it teaches stuff like that. So we can hang on the cross for as long as we want. Dolly Parton had a wonderful phrase, get off the cross, somebody could use the lumber. I love that one. So if we hang on the cross, it means we are holding on to that wound. And you do see this with people with conspiracy theories. They will hold on to the wound that the system has done this terrible thing and covered it up. And that wound becomes more important than whether or not it's true. The wound that the government is conspiring against us becomes more important than what we can do for ourselves and others. The wound holds us in place. We go round and round and round, seeking retribution. The other must be made to punish, be punished for this. The other must be made to suffer because we have been hurt. There's a song out by Pink at the moment, which is called What About Us, which is very much, it's very necessary, it's a very needed song, it's inspired a lot of people, but it's all about the woundedness, which is why aren't you saving us? For the mystic, nobody needs to save us as soon as we understand our divine nature. We don't need saving, we're saved, we're beyond saved. There's nothing to save. Even if we go horribly wrong, it's okay. Forgiveness is always there. We are always loved. We're going to have to pick up some karma, but God loves us whatever. There is no need for atonement. So if we die to the problem, which means we're willing to let go, we're willing to examine the prospect of forgiveness, then it's gone. We're free. We're alive again. We're full of life. We are not giving our spirit to feed darkness. And we've learnt this woundology over the last, the last century, the 20th century was when woundology really came out. I don't know if this is true, but I like the theory of Caroline Mace, who says that since the two world wars, which were so horrendous, And since the fact that we've got to know the world far better because of air travel and lately because of the internet, we've actually become bigger beings, if you like. We've moved up the chakras. We've opened our hearts. And that's wonderful because we have compassion all over the world. The amount of charity that goes on around the world is extraordinary. Though, of course, charity also can become the three levels of evil. The system of charity is that you've got to spend all your money if you're a big charitable organisation by the end of the tax year, or your allowance next year will go down. So the system is that charities will do everything they can to spend all their money before the end of the tax year, so they're justified in asking for more money the following year. The flesh with the charities is the folk who will go out and run the marathons, and they will then blend in with the devil, which will go around pointing out how good they are doing the running for charity. An awful lot of that is getting the strokes. You know, look at me, I'm the one running charities for marathons for charity. That doesn't mean to say they're not doing good. They're doing great good. But they're not addressing the root of the problem. They're raising money to help the system, which includes Big Pharma, to alleviate the problem when it's arrived, but not to solve the problem at the root. Solving of the problem at the root when it comes to something like cancer is to discover why our cancer rates are escalating. And they are. It isn't just that we're diagnosing earlier. I think cancer is 1 in 3 or 1 in 2 in the Western world now. And 100 years ago, it was less than 1 in 200. So that is a statistic of change which is phenomenal. And it's also come out with our woundology. So if we were living in the lower chakras most of the time beforehand, that meant we didn't get this woundology. If you understand the tree of life a little bit more, you realise that once you come out above the solar plexus chakra to the heart chakra, you're actually dealing with side triads, which we're going to talk about in a moment, which is the deep unconscious, which is our emotional wounds. Not our feelings. Our feelings are ephemeral, they pass. But the wounds, the deep stuff that is there and which feeds into what Eckhart Tolle would call our pain body. So it's only really since we've opened our hearts for good and for evil, you know, our hearts as in we are more loving, but also our hearts as in you done me wrong, it isn't fair, I want something better. I don't think this person is good enough for me, I'm not going to stick it out, I'm going to move on to somebody else, sexier, younger and prettier. And that's just the boys, the sexier, younger, prettier ones, I mean. Then we didn't really need divorce because you weren't in a relationship purely for the romantic love of it. You were in it for tribal reasons, social reasons, financial reasons, land reasons. Now from love, we expect passion and that to last forever. And guess what? It doesn't. So we have certainly become more open to love, which is a good thing. And we've become more open to our wounds, which is not necessarily a good thing. So these triads that I'm talking about, triads are the triangles on the tree of life in Jacob's ladder. Now, if you're watching live, you can see when I move my cursor in the purple world of Yetzirah on the ladder, there are 3 Sephirot on the outside column on the left-hand side. These are known as Binah, Gevurah and Hod, all of which link into Tiferet, which is the central column, which is our true self, the solar plexus column. The heart is represented by the triangle above this solar plexus Tiferet, which is known as the soul triad. Also on the right-hand side, there's 3 circles on the right-hand column of this Yetzeratic purple world, which are known as Chochmah, Hesed, and Netzach. And you'll notice that there are 2 triangles on either side which link to Tiferet, to the centre one. Just bear with me in this if you can't see it, and then later perhaps have another look at the diagram and see if you can work it out. Most of the triads or triangles on the Tree of Life, Jacob's Ladder, fit between worlds. The ones at the bottom, the very literal physical world, those are just one world. But the ones in the first purple kite, it's difficult to explain this if you don't know that, but in the bottom area between Tiferet and the bottom of the purple world, those triangles all link onto the central column. So they've got a contact with the central column, whereas the ones, and they're also linked with two worlds. They're linked to Yesod in Yetzeratic world, linked through to the Da'at in the physical world. So that series of triads is in two worlds. So it has different aspects working in it. Just bear with me on this. I'm not explaining it terribly well at the moment. But the blue triangle above Tiferet, the place of the solar plexus chakra, is also two worlds. It's the Yetzeratic psychological world and the spiritual world. So it's both spirit and psyche. But the triangles on the side are just the Yetzeratic world. They're just the world of the psyche. So therefore, they don't exist outside of our minds, our beliefs, our emotions. They are purely human. Animals don't have them, stones don't have them, plants don't have them. Animals, stones and plants exist in the lower world, linking through to the lower part of the Yetzeratic world. Humans are in all four worlds, but in the Yetzeratic world, these side triangles are formed by our thoughts, beliefs and complexes. Yes, they are bled into from what pain we have from the physical world and the spiritual world, but they are primarily formed by our own beliefs. And these are where our wounds are held. Slide number 16, that shows the Tree of Life, one of Zev Ben Shimon Halevi's diagrams. And if you look at that, you'll see that the triangles I was talking about, the one of the wounds on the left-hand side, are reason, constraints and communication feeding into the self, which shows our fears on the left-hand side. On the right-hand side, we've got revelation, releases and rhythms feeding into ourselves. And these are our pleasures. So one side is basically guilt, fear, pain, anger. The other side is delight, excitement, love and passion. So the right-hand side obviously is very popular with all of us, and the left-hand side, not at all. However, when we look at those in a little more detail in a minute, we're going to see exactly how unbalanced either side is. Just because it's pleasure doesn't mean to say it's necessarily good, unfortunately. But let's look at this idea of wounds again. Wounds are generally unforgiven betrayal. Now, when a wound heals in the physical body, it will leave a little bit of a scar if it heals well, and a bad scar if it doesn't heal well, and that works in the psychological world as well. Jesus was betrayed by Judas. Now, I've written a whole novel about this, the Book of Deborah, about whether or not this was a good or a bad thing, and whether Jesus needed Judas, and whether Judas was actually the most loyal of the disciples by handing Jesus over at that time. Because let's face it, if Jesus had been stabbed in a back street by one of the Sanhedrin and then resurrected afterwards, nobody would have believed it because nobody would have seen him die. For the resurrection story to work, it's got to have been viewed. The resurrection story is perfectly quantum in that the story is changed by the observation of the people who saw it happen. If Jesus had just died in a back street, no Christianity at all. So did Judas betray Jesus or hand him over? The word paradidomi, which is used, can mean either. But the secret behind this is that Jesus forgives. And the evidence here in Matthew and the other Gospels, and forthwith he came to Jesus and said, "Hail Master," and kissed him, to kiss many times tenderly. So if he's kissing Jesus tenderly, that means he's the biggest hypocrite in the whole wide world, or this is a setup, just like in Genesis. So the kiss is genuine, and Jesus returns it. Jesus does not go around blaming Jesus. Jesus doesn't even mention Judas when he's allegedly channeling through Paul of Tarsus, because Jesus is obviously speaking to Paul. There's the revelation on the road to Damascus. And there are times when Paul says, "I have instructions from the Lord." And he also says, I do not have instructions on this. On marriage, he says, on this matter, I have no instruction from Jesus. And yet he goes to lay down the law all the same. So Paul is definitely channeling. And you would think that if there were any unforgiveness or any need to even name or mention Judas, that that message would get through. But it is not mentioned at all. And in John, this is slide number 18, Judas knew where Jesus was going to be because Jesus went there often. And Jesus knew that Judas knew that. So Jesus waited in the Garden of Gethsemane voluntarily. Yes, he prayed and said, if this cup can be taken from it, please do. But it wasn't. He stayed there. He took it. He was there for a purpose. Now, some people say, why was he there? And it may well be that he knew that this was exactly what he came to do. It may be that he created it by knowing that. It may be that it was part of a divine plan. We really simply don't know. But looking at it as an accident or something that shouldn't have happened is not going to help us in any way, shape or form at any of these levels. So we can say, literally, Judas betrayed him. It was a bad thing to do. We will hate Judas. Or we can say, what's really going on here? Why was Jesus hanging around for this? Why did Jesus not make a run for it when he knew one of the disciples was going to betray him? There has to be more beneath this. The third one is, what does this story tell me? Am I really angry with Judas? Do I hate Judas? Do I despise him? Do I want to paint him with a dark skin and ugly as a foreigner, as a person who's different? What is this telling me about my attitude to the outsider? And the metaphysical level is, what is this telling humanity? And it's quite difficult for us at the lower levels to see that Jesus knew what was going to happen and why it was going to happen and was perfectly okay about it. And he owned up when they said, we're seeking Jesus, he said, I am he. He didn't have to do that. Just think that through. He did not have to be there. He chose. And while we're talking at these four levels, Jesus' crucifixion story is told very clearly in four different levels in the Gospels. Now we've got Matthew, who's the physical world, blending into the world of the psyche, the lower part of the psyche where the ego is. So Matthew is all about the pain of the crucifixion and the physicality of it. Matthew and Mark carry the same words from Jesus, which are, my God, why have you forsaken me? On the PowerPoint here on number 19, I've got to get the order of the words in the order that you're going to read, but actually the tree needs to be read from the bottom up, so we have sort of the opposite of Hebrew here. Instead of needing to write to left, we kind of need to read from the bottom up. But I have put it at the top down, so I hope that's not confusing you. On slide number 19, we've got it in the right order. So I'm going to ask Lion to edit that whole bit, and I'm going to come back to this bit. Slide 19, Jesus' word on the cross. If you look at that PowerPoint on number 19, you'll see that they're actually in the correct order, with the words from Matthew and Mark at the bottom, then the words from Luke in the middle and the words from John at the top. Because Matthew is the physical world, the world of pain and suffering. And Jesus was in pain and he was suffering. And the physical body, when it's in pain, cries out. So my God, why have you forsaken me? Is what the physical body is going to be crying out. Mark is the psyche. And the psyche, the undeveloped psyche, not understanding why the betrayal has happened, it's going to do the same. It's going to cry out, my God, why have you forsaken me? Luke is the spirit. And Luke is the world of Berea feeding down to the soul. So the soul level of the human being is the psyche and the spirit. And once we start to look at things from the soul, we transform. We talked last week of the two malefactors, one of whom who understood that he was receiving his karma, he was working from the soul. The one at the level of the ego did not understand that and said to Jesus, you should take us down from the cross. Jesus in the Gospel of Luke is speaking at the level of the soul and the spirit, where he says, Father, forgive them. They don't know what they do. And that is the answer for forgiveness. They don't know what they're doing. The second you assume the person knows how evil you're perceiving them to be or how evil their action may be, then you've got blame and you are crucified. Because most people really don't know what they're doing. Most people really cannot help it. Most people are acting in the way they believe will bring them the most relief for whatever is going on. Yes, terrible things happen. Terrible things happen. It's not that I'm sitting here on some kind of pedestal. Our best friend was murdered back in 2006. We know the level of evil that can happen in this world. But the only way to get our own peace of mind from that, and the only way his son could get his peace of mind from that, was by letting go and understanding that there might have been a wider picture going on there. In the case of John, the guy who was murdered, he was in his 60s, he was unwell, he was hideously in debt, he'd got problems with his home, and he was deeply unhappy. He'd just got divorced for the second time, and he'd found a nasty lump in his back that he was very worried about. When he was murdered, he actually saved the life of somebody and was killed during the process of saving the life. So his death was a massive gift to that woman, a massive paying off of karma, and also it was his opportunity, a red flag point, to leave a life which was becoming a burden to him. So when we thought that through, we all went, way to go, John, and way to go, guy who killed him. Because, okay, that guy has accrued for karma, certainly. But the killing of John led to the police catching that guy whom they'd been after for a long, long time. So John's death served the community as well. John's death served humanity in that respect. John's death served him. And John's death probably served the man who killed him by taking him off the streets to get his drug habit dealt with. He's in a psychiatric institution now. And in the Gospel of Luke, Jesus also says, today you will be with me in paradise. He says it to the second malefactor, but he's also talking to us. That if we let go, if we understand that we have had a part in what has happened to us, a part in creating it with our projections onto the world, then we can leave the cross and get to paradise. And the third thing Jesus says is, Father, into thy hands I commend my spirit. And that is the secret of giving our issues to God. Give them to God. If we don't know how to forgive, give it to God. We'll come back to that. You'll notice by now that this one's going to run seriously over time because we've got a lot of slides still to go. So this is going to be a very long webinar and some of the others may be shorter, and I'm sure you don't mind with that. And the final Gospel, John's Gospel, Jesus says none of these things except, woman, behold thy son, giving his mother into the care of John. And in that way, he's actually showing the two sides of the tree of life. Because Mary stands on the left, on the side of the feminine column, and John stands on the right, on the side of the masculine column. So there's some speculation that Jesus, at that point, is taking the role of the high priest in the Holy of Holies, speaking to the columns in the original temple, the left-hand column of Asherah and the right-hand column of Yahweh. He's sort of holding them together, pulling them together in one on the central column. He also says, I'm thirsty, which to the mystic means that he's risen above the watery world. He's going to the world of spirit. He's come out of the land where water quenches thirst. And then he says, it is done. Job done, job finished. And that's very much Johannine. If you look at the Gospel of John, it's not about stories about Jesus doing great statements. This is how it is. And he just goes, it's done, job done. Lesson taught, I've done it. Also, it's very worthwhile reading the 22nd Psalm. Because many people believe that Jesus was actually quoting that on the cross. It does start off, it's one of the Davidic Psalms of Redemption, which starts off with betrayal, and then forgiveness, and then it ends up with saying it's over. So that psalm actually has the phrases, my God, why have you forsaken me? And then forgiveness, and then it is done. So it's entirely possible that the words from that psalm have been put into Jesus' words. So betrayal being the evil, the problem. Society betrays itself all the time. Yes, we want to turn up at the supermarket, we want to have our cheap blueberries, which means we're going to fly them in the winter from Chile, which is basically a betrayal of sustainability. In many ways, it's a betrayal. We betray our bodies by buying the wrong food, maybe buying food that's not organic, by living with the system, by assuming that we can live as a vegan and be sustainable, which we can't. There's nothing wrong with being vegan, but you have to understand that if you're living in somewhere like the United Kingdom, it can't be done without the system. So if you're accusing the system of betrayal, but you're still using the system by using the food that comes via Big Pharma or the big corporations or from the other side of the world, you have to understand that you are part of the evil of the system. And if you're going around saying, I'm better than everybody else, guess what? You've become the devil's level. So it's all about betrayal, really. What are we betraying? And Jesus came solely to treat us forgiveness, to get through this concept of betrayal. Slide number 21 now shows the betrayals of the left-hand triad of constraints, self-communications, and the right-hand triad of self-release and rhythms. And the betrayals of fear and guilt and anger are blame, shame, laziness, passive aggression, apathy, judgment, criticism, humiliation. I'm sure you can think up some more. And the betrayals of the right-hand side, which is the side which is predicated on pleasure, are addictions. That's the one that says, another bar of chocolate won't hurt, another hit of cocaine won't hurt, another smoke of cannabis won't hurt. Maybe one won't, but repeating them certainly will. Overgiving, that's when you run yourself ragged for everybody else and don't take care of yourself. Overdoing, excessive mercy, which is turning a blind eye, or codependency, active anger and aggression, adultery, gossip, carelessness, and obsession. And what we tend to do when we get caught in this unconscious battle is we become bipolar. We go from one side to the other. We go from pain and shame and guilt to excess of delight or joy, and then we flip back again, because if we haven't got this holding point in the minute, in a second, in the now, the ability to come to our senses, to understand that we don't need to add to this pain, come to our senses means actually tune into this pain and where it's coming from, to come to our actual self, then we are going to be lost in the addictions, and we are going to hang on that cross forever. So the Christian story is simply telling us that betrayal is part of spiritual growth. We will be betrayed, and also no one can betray us without our permission. Because no matter what anybody does to us, it's our judgment on what they do that predicates how we're going to feel about it. If somebody comes along to you and says, you are a one-footed unicorn with purple hair, you're going to go, no, I'm not. What? And it's not going to hurt you at all. But if somebody says, you are a fat, ugly, shameful animal, some of that is going to hit those side triads in the side of your unconscious. Whether you think you're fat, whether you've had shame, some of that is going to bite, because it's going to have what's known as a Lucific truth in it. It's going to have a little bit of truth. And it's only going to be hurtful if you haven't dealt with that aspect of your triad, of your psyche. So if the part of you believes that there's an iota of truth in that, you're going to hang on the cross about it. So nobody can betray us without our belief that something in what they say is true. And if we believe it's a betrayal, if we blame the other for doing something to us, we will be crucified and we will crucify them. And the longer we view it as betrayal, the more that is going to hurt. So, slide 23, to end the crucifixion, we must forgive. We must die to the problem. As soon as we stop feeding the problem, it will die. The pain body requires to be fed. And as soon as we stop feeding it, it starves to death, it dies, and we are set free from that pain body. But of course, forgiveness is a big, big issue for all of us. It's easy enough to say that forgiveness sets us free. It actually has nothing to do with the other person at all. Forgiveness never means to condone what was done. It never means that what is done was right. It doesn't mean what was done didn't hurt. It doesn't mean to say that what was done should have happened at all. But it just means I'm going to set myself free from the emotional pain of it. I might be walking around with a physical wound that will never heal, but surely that wound is going to hurt more if I won't deal with the psychological pain around it. I have a very dear friend with fibromyalgia. I'm not saying that everybody with fibromyalgia is like this at all, but this lady has got it through a mental and emotional pain, and this fibromyalgia is one of the things that's definitely coming from the side triads, because the brain is registering huge amounts of pain which aren't physically obvious in the body and will not show up in an MRI scan in any way. That pain's real, but it's so overflowing that the brain is having to interpret it as being a physical pain to try and get the person to do something about it. This lady went to see an amazing healer down the road from us who cleared the whole of her pain in 1 2-hour session. Within a month, she'd got it back again because she was thinking the same thoughts. She went back to the healer, he took it away again. She went away, in 2 months, she got it all back again. She went back to the healer, he took it all away again. All the time he's been teaching her and telling her what she needs to do, and she's trying to take it on board. She's trying. And she took 3 months to get back to the pain, but she's back to the pain now. And of course now she's afraid to go back to the healer because she feels she's a failure. That's one of her unconscious patterns. I am a repeated failure. So she's creating this again and again to get her back on the cross of self-failure. He'll see her again and he'll take away the pain as many times as it needs to be taken away. All she's got to do is keep going to see him until the pattern of release and forgiveness has become automatic. And the thing is that other people generally hurt us the once. But we go over it and over it and over it and over it and over it so that our thoughts hurt us 1,000 times. That's the difference between 6 hours on the cross and 2,000 years on the cross. And we use our wounds as weapons. You know, I can't forget. I can't succeed because of what they did to me. I can't move on. I can't live a healthy life. I can't write. I can't have a book published. I can't be happy. You can't expect me to do that. You can't expect me to turn up. You can't expect me to give you a lift because of my wound. It's such an easy excuse not to live. So it's very useful to have these wounds so that we can go on blaming the others. And another one of the wounds is, if I knew why this happened, maybe I could recover a little. That's a whole psychological wormhole that we all go into. I want to know why it happened. And spiritual folk really get into this one. We want to know about past lives and karma and all that kind of thing. If it relieves us, fine. But it's perfect simple to let it go without knowing any of that stuff. Because quite often we're going to get into more blame if we work out why it happened. So we will use our wounds to deny our power, which is exactly the opposite of the Christian message. If we believe the other hurt us and they hold the power, then we don't believe we've got power to heal. Slide number 26. We forgive from the level of the soul. The soul on the tree of life floats above these side triads which carry our wounds, which means we have to be conscious. The soul triad is the place of free will, human consciousness. So we have to rise above it. We have to say it's over. That was then and this is now. We forgive in the present tense. And we have to realise that it's the repetitive thoughts which are crucifying us, not the initial act. We are feeding vampires by going through those thoughts again and again. So on slide 27, quick technique on how to forgive, because it would be terrible to leave you with the injunction that you must forgive without any way of doing it. Firstly, stop telling the story of your wound. One of the wounds in my life has been my relationship with my mother, which is vastly better than it has been. But people say to me, well, you used to tell funny stories about your mother. Why don't you use that in your comedy? They were hilarious. Well, part of my healing with the relationship in my mother was to start making it funny instead of making it hurtful. But I realized after a while that even if I was making those stories funny, I was still telling the stories. I'd still love to tell you some of the stories, but they would reinfect the wound. And the whole goal of my life is to heal that wound and to be forgiveness. She did many things to me which I learnt later she couldn't have helped because of her psychological state at the time and her karmic duty and debt. So what she did and what she didn't do wasn't her fault at all. And I can hold on to it or I can let go of it. But if I keep telling the story of the wounds, even to make people laugh, I am reinfecting it. Only when I am 100% healed and when she's dead probably, can I use those as comedy. And then I'll probably have to change them so that they don't ignite a long sleeping wound, just in case there's one still there. The technique of Ho'oponopono is superb. It's the phrase of four phrases. I love you, I'm sorry, please forgive me, thank you. I put the link on Wikipedia on the PowerPoint on page 27, so you can go and have a look at it if you don't know about it. How this works is the repetition reprograms the neural pathways of the brain. And the neural pathways will be holding on to the wounds because we've thought about them so often. So there are electrical impulses going in patterns in the brain to reinfect the wound. I love you, I'm sorry, please forgive me, thank you. Repeated, even if you don't mean it, forms new neural pathways. So it makes us easier to change our minds. And if you can get to the point where you're doing Ho'oponopono to the extent that if you wake up in the middle of the night and go to the loo and your brain goes automatically into I love you, I'm sorry, please forgive me, thank you, you will be getting off that cross any minute now, trust me. Another way is to ask for help. Just to say, please help me forgive. Because the whole of the Christ consciousness in humanity is predicated on helping us forgive, to stop judging, to come to our Christ help. The help is there in the angelic world. If we just say, I don't know how to forgive, take this burden. Take it. I give it to you. I give it to you, Jesus, or I give it to you, Christ. I give it to you, God. I give it to you, angelic realms. Take it away and give it. Just keep giving it. My rector, Paul Seton Byrne, says he's got some spirit sight, and he says he sees people walk up to the altar in his church, go down on their knees, give their issue to God, relax, and then they pick up the issue when they leave and walk out of the church with it, because they don't know how to leave it behind. If we could actually leave it behind, God will take it away from us. And understanding the nature of spirit is part of that, which is to say, into thy hands I give this problem. Jesus said, into thy hands I commend my spirit. And he's actually saying, I give it all to you. I'm giving you the pain. I'm giving you my perception of it. I'm giving all of it, and I will resurrect. On page 28, there's a prayer to forgive, in case that's any use to you. And on page 29, some of the teachings of Teresa of Avila has been translated by Caroline Mace in a book called Entering the Castle, which is a huge book of exercises and meditations to get you through the seven levels of the interior castle, which are the seven levels in the Tree of Life. And the book teaches, and Teresa's work teaches. Teresa's very difficult to read. It's a very long book in Interior Castle and difficult to read. But it teaches that all wounds heal if they're allowed to do so. I had a client who was dying from cancer, a healing client. She cut her forehead while she was terminal ill, and the wound on her forehead healed because there was no emotional wound attached to it. The emotional wound that was the root of her cancer was not healing, and she wasn't willing to heal it. Therefore, the cancer kept growing. Even cancer can be healed if you cut out the wound that is feeding it and feeding it and feeding it. Wounds that do not heal are wounds that are poisoned or kept open emotionally. Unhealed wounds require huge amounts of energy. We're given a portion of spirit grace every day. And we can use that portion of grace of spirit for whatever we want. We can use it for creativity, we can use it for health, we can use it for happiness, or we can use it to focus on our misery and our pain. And guess what? That's where the spirit will go, and it will feed the pain body, and we will just get more. It's the law of karma. If we will use the amount of spirit given us to us every day for joy, then we will starve the wounds. And if we can release just one bit each day, it gives us so much strength. We will start resurrection immediately. So you can end these wound agreements, which is what Caroline Mace calls them, by three statements. These are physical, psychological, and spiritual statements to help us retain our divine statement, our divine heritage. The first one is, nothing has hurt me. Now, your psyche is going to go, of course things have hurt me. So-and-so has hurt me. This has hurt me. My left foot will never be the same. This has hurt me. This has hurt me. But if you naturally go, no, this was part of my life's learning, necessary suffering, and possibly even a lesson, it hasn't hurt me. If you can acknowledge, I am not at this moment hurt, you've done the first huge stage. You've stepped out of, my God, why have you forsaken me? The second one is, this agreement is over. Because in your brain, this neural pathway to go back to the suffering again and again is an agreement that you've made with yourself. And if you just keep saying, this agreement is over, whenever you think of the wound, no, this agreement is over, no. Catherine Ponder calls it the healthy stage of denial, which is, no, I will not think this again. No, I will not play this game. No, I will not hand out blame. No, I will not tell that story. This agreement is over. And the third one is, and I claim my spirit back. And the power in that. Just stand there with your arms in what's known as the Orion's position, with your arms up going, I claim my spirit back. So try it. No. Nothing has hurt me. No, this agreement is over. Yes, I claim my spirit back. So these come nicely through the words of Jesus. My God, why have you forsaken me? I am betrayed. I am in pain. I hurt. It's not fair. I shouldn't be here. Oh God, how could you let me down like this? Father, forgive them. They don't know what they're doing. Today you shall be with me in paradise. Father, into thy hands I commend my spirit. Nothing has hurt me. This agreement is over. Oh my goodness. I'm out of it. It's over. It's over. And it is finished. I claim my spirit back. It's done. Nothing else to do. Don't need to worry about it. Phew. So, in the soul, this is the final picture. So you can all have a rest and a nice cup of tea now. Between the Sephirot of Tiferet in the centre, Gevurah on the left and Hesed on the right is the triad known as the soul triad, which is fed by this triad of spirit, which is Binah, Tiferet, Chochmah. The triad of spirit feeds the triad of the soul. If we can say, nothing has hurt me, which means I'm alive, I'm well, this agreement is over, I will not let spirit be fed off, and I claim my spirit back. What you're saying is, I claim the spirit into my soul. I will listen to divinity. I will be Christ consciousness. I will be who I came here to be. I claim my spirit back. And I will look up for the answers. Everything about Kabbalah is look up for the answer. Go directly to God for the answer. So that's your webinar. And your homework is to find a wound in your psyche, which is your crucifixion, and to do one of the practices on this PowerPoint, probably Ho'oponopono, or just giving it to God repeatedly for the next week and see how that works. Get off the cross. Someone could use the lumber, and take your spirit back.